Well, first of all, it's drawing on some of the on one of the oldest storytelling traditions there is, which is the tradition of folk tale, fairy tale, and fable that you know that exists in every culture. But in my case, the variation of it that I became most familiar with as a young person were these what are now called the wonder tales of the East, of which the Arabian Nights obviously is the most famous. But you know the kind of joke of the book in the passage that you read is that it's actually narrated from 1,000 years in the future.
Yes.
So that the past they're talking about is us today, except what survives of us is a mixture of fact and legend. Just as you know, if I was to write a book now set in 1,000 AD, that period is. You know, it's what gets called the Dark Ages, and some of it is known, some of it is not known. I mean, that's the time, just about the time, allegedly, of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. I mean, and did they even really exist?
Hmm.
You know, so I thought it actually gave me a way of finding the tone of voice of this book, to imagine these people in the distant future looking back at our time, in the way that we would look back 1,000 years from ago. And for it to become this mixture of recorded facts and legends and half facts of, you know, what Stephen Colbert called truthiness.
Yes.
You know, and that allowed me to make the book this kind of mixture of fact and fantasy that it became.
Well, yes. Scheherazade, the stories she told to delay her execution in the 1001 Nights. With this book, I think you've become Scheherazalman.
Well, thank you. That's the highest compliment one could be paid, because she's, of course, probably the greatest storyteller in the history of literature. I mean, one of the things I've always loved about the story of Scheherazade is that it talks about the power of literature to civilize barbarians. You know, I mean, she marries this king who has been deflowering and murdering virgins for a couple of years, every night. And she not only does she stop him doing it, but over the course of 1001 nights, she really changes him. You know, and he by the end of the story, he's a much more civilized human being. And that extraordinary parable of the civilizing power of literature, I think, accounts for some of the, you know, so it's one of the reasons why she survives as such an immortal figure.
Mm. Tragically, with the fatwa, you did not have that sort of uplifting experience. And I wonder, too, if that accounted for much of your feeling drawn to Scheherazade in writing this.
Well, I mean, you know, I've always been in love with the Arabian Nights stories since I was a young person, but certainly the question of the connection between literature and death, between the danger for writers in doing what they do, is something that I, you know, became unusually aware of because of what happened around the time of the publication of the Satanic Verses. But really, I mean, one of the things I wanted to do in this book is for it really not to be about me, if you know what I mean. There isn't really a me character in the book.
Really?
I wanted it to, not really. No, I mean, I know there's a character who almost has my name.
Yes.
But that's a kind of deliberate joke.
You mean Ibn Rushd, the philosopher?
Ibn Rushd, yeah. The philosopher. I mean, who I admire. You know, I mean, who's a philosopher whose ideas I admire and respect, and so he found his way into this book. Because he's been in my mind for a long time, in the same way as as in The Enchantress of Florence, you know, Niccolo Machiavelli found his way in because he'd been somebody I'd thought about for a long time. So it's really because of my fascination with him rather than any simple identification with him.
Well, there's a cautionary tale, so to speak, because in reading this novel, I thought it felt very autobiographical. But I guess that's...
Well, I mean, it is in the sense that it's me writing it, you know what I mean? So it comes out of my sensibility and my concerns. And I think, you know, I'm actually very glad to have got back to fiction and to be able to offer visions of the world in a fictional form rather than in nonfiction, like the memoir that I wrote immediately before this. Because this is my natural ground, you know? I mean, I never set out to be a nonfiction writer. I set out to be a teller of tales, you know, and it's great to get back to that.
Well, in this tale, Dunia is an amazing heroine. She's extraordinary among the djinn.
Which is the word that we, in English, becomes genie, yes.
Well, Dunia is extraordinary in her capacity for love. I was wondering if you would read... the last paragraph on page 145, beginning with the second sentence.
Maybe in the case of true humans, their mind, their soul, their consciousness flows through their bodies like blood, inhabiting every cell of their physical being. And so Aristotle was right. In humans, the mind and body are one and cannot be separated. The self is both with the body and perishes with it too. She imagined that union with a thrill. How lucky human beings were if that was the case. She wanted to tell Geronimo, who was and was not Ibn Rushd, lucky and doomed. When their hearts pounded with excitement, their souls pounded too. When their pulses raced, their spirits were aroused. When their eyes moistened with tears of happiness, it was their minds that felt the joy. Their minds touched the people their fingers touched, and when they in turn were touched by others, it was as if two consciousnesses were briefly joined. The mind gave the body sensuality. It allowed the body to taste delight and to smell love in their lover's sweet perfume. Not only their bodies, but their minds too, made love. And at the end, the soul, as mortal as the body, learned the last great lesson of life, which was the body's death.
It's exquisite.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things in the book is, I mean, it's, you know, it's a celebration of human nature. And way of doing it is to have these supernatural beings, the djinn, kind of envious of human beings for being more complicated than they are, for doing more diverse things, for being more interesting than they are. The djinn might have these supernatural powers, but they're not that interesting. And they come to meddle in human affairs because they actually are fascinated by human beings who are in some ways superior to them.
You say they lack management skills.
Yeah.
I love that.
The djinn are not very well organized.
Well, I can identify with that. So the novel opens in 12th century Spain, but then moves to 21st century New York?
Yeah, I mean, I think of it as being set the day after tomorrow.
Ah. You know?
I think it's essentially New York City as it is now, but with some little variations, such as that the mayor is a woman of my invention rather than the actual mayor. But other than that, it's really, I hope, a recognizable New York City of this time.
Well, it is, and New York is experiencing some very unusual events, even for New York. These are the strangenesses.
The strangenesses, yes. I wanted to sort of make a portrait of a world out of joint, you know, a world in which the ordinary rules that people think govern life have randomly and erratically ceased to apply. And And to do that in this fantastic way was just a way of making metaphorical what I think many people feel about how the world is now, that it is full of strangenesses.
And Mr. Geronimo.
My gardener.
Yes, he's Ibn Rushd's descendant. What is significant about his occupation?
Well, what I thought was, you know, he was sort of the beginning of the book for me. He was the first character I had. This gardener. I thought in the beginning, before I had worked the book out fully, I thought it might just be a book about him, because, you know, he's a gardener who mysteriously comes unstuck from the ground. The laws of gravity stop working properly, but he doesn't just float off into the sky. He's like half an inch off the ground, mm-hmm. which you know, is as great a disruption of the law of gravity as if he was a mile in the sky. But it's, how shall I put it, it's funnier. And I thought he might, it's a kind of Kafka idea, you know, about a man who mysteriously is metamorphosed for reasons that are never explained to him, and who has to deal with the consequences of that metamorphosis. You know, so the problem of being half an inch off the ground, I think if you're going to have a crazy idea like that, you have to take it completely literally. What would be the consequences of it? How would you drive a car when you are floating half an inch above the seat? How would you go to the bathroom? You know, how would you walk down the street without people being either terrified or some such, you know, reacting badly towards you? So I thought maybe I was going to tell a story about this gardener, this man whose whole life has been dedicated to the love of the earth, the nurturing of the earth and the things that grow in it, that he should be the one who gets detached from the earth, who loses the ground beneath his feet. That would be both comic and poignant. You know, it's a kind of sad comedy.
Well, it also gave you the opportunity to bring in Voltaire's Candide and all the extra meaning of making our garden grow.
Yes, of course, in Candide, when Candide says to the philosopher Pangloss that, you know, we must just cultivate our garden, it's a sentence of defeat. It's a sentence saying we should retreat from the world into our little private cocoon and not try to adventure or to experience the world widely. We just stay home and cultivate our little patch of the earth. So, I mean, Candide says this after his life has taken him through an enormous number of vicissitudes and hardships, and he's exhausted. But I thought you could use that phrase to mean something else. Mm-hmm. You could use it to refer to a kind of nurturing, to a kind of love of the earth. And cultivating one's garden didn't have to be simply defeatist. It could actually be creative.